on our agenda for you today. We are first going to hear from Representative Erickson's bill, which is one that was included last year in the omnibus bill, and probably won't need a lot of time here today because we did pass it last year. Then we are going to hear from two of our museums that provide programming for children that are funded by the state to a certain extent, and I thought it might be nice to have some idea of what they do, how do we justify their existence and the funds that they get. And then lastly, we will have a report from the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research on school funding, which is the second of the two school funding reports that I plan to hear this year. We've already heard the Finance Task Force, Rick Dressen, earlier a couple of weeks ago. So, Representative Erickson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I would like to move House File 27 for possible inclusion in the Education Omnibus Bill. I am happy to report that the Governor has also included this in his proposal, and you heard Representative Sikora say earlier that this was also included in both the Senate and House omnibus bills last year, so I think perhaps it'll make it this year. Madam Chair, I think it's really important today that we hear from Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, who were so kind as to prepare many handouts to help us understand what maximum effort capital loans are, who has received them. So there's a loan balance summary also to show us where they are in their repayment schedule. Of course, what the bill does is emphasize the fact that there may have been a glitch in the tax reform of some years ago that has placed a burden on these districts' taxpayers as they try to repay the loan. And with me is Police Superintendent Fred Nolan, who will address the issue first. But Madam Chair, I think it would be good to hear from Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom first.
Yes, I think that would be a good idea. I think members, if you will, first of all, if you look in your packet that goes with this bill, you will see a number of pieces of paper. We always have paper. And they will give you information on our maximum effort school aid law. There is another one that tells you the loan balances, et cetera. And I think we'll have, I don't know which of you wants to start, Mr. Crow?
Yes.
Mr. Strom? Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, a couple of pieces of paper to start with. The first of those is the bill summary. There's a fairly expansive description of what the 2001 change was. And let me just start with that, and then we'll move on to a little more discussion about the program itself. In 2001, we compressed class rates as part of the tax reform that was proposed. What that did is it threw off our definition of tax base. Statewide, we had 37% less tax base when measured by net tax capacity than we did before the session began because of the reform. The reforms were agreed to in conference committee. The House and Senate bills and the governor all had very different approaches going into conference committee. So there wasn't a lot of time at the end to figure out how to make some of these adjustments. So what happened with a number of formulas, including the maximum effort capital loan formula, was we simply took the statewide drop in tax base, about the 37% that it dropped, and we increased all the school funding formulas that were specified as a tax rate. They're just ratios, lower base, higher rate, raised the same amount of money on average statewide. That worked fairly well for most of the formulas. It did not work well for the maximum effort capital loan formula. And the reason for that is that the districts that have maximum effort capital loans have a very different tax base than the state on average. Those districts tend not to have much commercial industrial property, which was the biggest class of property getting the reductions in 2001. So the result was the maximum effort tax rate, which is specified in statute at that time at 24%, went up to 32%, but a more uniform adjustment that for just those districts would have been about between a 28 and a 29% rate. So essentially that's what created the need for this bill was the change that was at the end of the legislative session for the maximum effort tax rate. What this bill is asking to do is lower that tax rate, and we'll get to that in a minute, but I thought it'd be helpful to go through a few of the basics behind the maximum effort program first. The maximum effort program, there's a blue sheet in your packet labeled frequently asked questions about the maximum effort loan program. And that tries in one page. I had to use long paper, of course, but in one page to try and summarize for you most of the issues about that program. The Maximum Effort Capital Loan Program dates from 1959, and the purpose of that program was to help very low property value school districts, often with fast-growing enrollment, to build new school buildings. It was designed as a loan program initially, and many of the early applicants for the money were fast-growing suburban districts that are now quite property wealthy. Many of those districts repaid their capital loans. We also made a number of capital loans in the last 20 years. Many of those went to small districts, districts in greater Minnesota, and many of those districts probably don't have much chance of having a greatly increased tax base. As a result, a lot of the districts that currently have capital loans will probably not repay them. There is a repayment period specified in statute. For a while, that was 30 years. That was changed a number of years ago now, so that new capital loans have to go for 50 years before they're fully forgiven. And let me describe to you just basically how the Maximum Effort Program works. Essentially, what happens is we calculate how much the local district can bond on its own. Let's say they're going to build a $20 million elementary school. We figure out what their tax base can support on their own through a formula. And in this example, let's say that's $5 million. And then the remaining $15 million that they need would come from the state through the sale of state general obligation bonds. Then what the district does each year is it makes a tax levy to repay those bonds, and it uses something called the maximum effort tax rate. And that's this number we talked about, the 24% that's now 32%. That's the tax rate that they have to levy each year. And they take the proceeds from that 32% tax rate and they apply them to the local bonds first. And then whatever is left over, they apply to the state to repay their state loan. If what they turn into the state that year is not enough to repay the interest, then the interest that's not paid gets added to the existing principal balance, and that grows over time. So for many of the districts that aren't going to repay their loan, it's a little like a credit card debt. And if you're adding it to the amount that the interest is being charged on. So when you go to the last sheet that you've got, the one that was handed out, that's a single white sheet that's got numbers on it. What that shows is the remaining districts with capital loans. In the very right-hand two columns, the first one shows the initial loan amount, and then the last one shows the estimated principal and interest that they'll owe as of June 30th of this coming year. And the purpose of that is to show you what those loan amounts originally were and then how much has been paid back. You'll see that most of those districts do owe more than what they originally borrowed. And again, the reason for that is most of their 32% is going to pay off the local bonds. The remainder then gets sent to the state to make a payment on the state's on the state bonds. If there's not enough to pay the state bonds out of the state general fund, we make an interest payment, and then we add that to the school district's balance. Now, for most of those loans, they've either got a 30 or a 50 year date. A lot of them are at 30 years. Usually, the school bond is issued for 20 years, so they're going to have about 10 years at the end where they're only going to be repaying the state. So, in general, we'd expect that those payments will be heavily concentrated toward the end of the term of the maximum effort. A couple other quick points for you. The Maximum Effort Program predated the Debt Service Equalization Aid Program. So prior to 1993, when we had debt equalization, the only help for building help was through the Maximum Effort Program. However, starting in 1993, we had the Debt Service Equalization Aid Program. That really cut down the number of districts that looked at the maximum effort as a way to get new school funding. A number of districts have refinanced their maximum effort loans and paid those off over the last 5 years and are now just using debt equalization. So what shows up on the sheet entitled Loan Balance Summary are just those districts with loan balances outstanding, and you can see the amounts outstanding and the date that the loan will be canceled if it's not repaid. So the program is designed as a loan program, although it's expected that there will be forgiveness of some, if not a majority, of the loans at the end of their term, which is either a 30 or a 50-year term. One final note about before we talk about the mechanism of the bill in front of you today about the capital loan program, is that if the project is to get a capital loan, that project needs to be approved by the Department of Education. They do a review and comment on that program. Then the local district needs to hold a referendum to approve the sale of bonds. Then they need to come to the legislature, and the legislature needs to do two things. They need to both approve that maximum effort project, and they need to appropriate the bond proceeds for that program. So in summary, Mr. Chair, that's how the maximum effort program works. There's a little three-page handout in your packet that says maximum effort school aid law. That's taken from the Blue School Finance Guide, and that is a summary of how we actually calculate the local share of the bonds. A couple of quick things for you to look at there on the last page of that, what's labeled Table 17 shows you the total amount of state bonds that have been sold for the program and the years in which those bonds were sold. And just so you get a sense of the size of the magnitude of the program, since its inception, about $271 million of state bonds have been sold for school building purposes through the Maximum Effort Loan Program. And you can see that there was some very heavy use of that program in the late 80s and early 90s, and then also again in 95, 2000, 2001, there were some significant dollar amounts to the program that year as well.
Mr. Strom, I have one question. Go to the loan balance summary, where it says date loan cancels if not repaid. Are there some typographical errors on the loan repayment dates?
Mr. Chair, I think we've got a problem with the two-date field. That should be the Red Lake one would be a 50-year loan, so that should be 2051 on the Red Lake. Yeah. So anything that has a retroactive date, those should really be 2000 and something. I apologize for the proofreading on this.
Yeah, just
that's a date problem there.
Yeah, just wanted clarification.
Thank you.
Representative Heider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Newman. But anyways, Tim, just a question. When I'm looking at the loan balance summary, obviously Red Lake will not have the ability to pay that off. So that's just going to be forgiveness, right? That's all.
Mr. Chair, yes, that will be forgiven.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? President Clinton.
Thank you. Mr. Strom, just with regards to Representative Heidgerken's question, because you had mentioned there is a place in the blue sheet where it says that the districts probably won't be able to get a new building if they are on this list because they have such a low property tax and they have such a large amount owed. And it seems like if Red Lake's on here and they're also coming before us, how does that square, I guess, with some of the answers to the frequently asked questions on the blue sheet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Klinsing, what I meant to imply there was the district would not be able to build a school on their own. They'd need state assistance in order to do that. And there's a process in the capital loan program that says you can, once you have a capital loan, that you can get another loan for a certain number of years, and then there's a prohibition after that time period of additional loans.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Okay, so the you said there's a formula that you go through. Where is that formula in our blue book?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that formula is both in the blue book and then also on page two of the mainly on page two of the three-page handout that explains how much the local share of the project is.
Ms.
Representative Clinton.
So in that formula, is there any way place in that formula where it pretty much says the district can't handle any more debt at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clinton, yes, that's the argument essentially behind where the numbers are chosen from is how much debt the school district could take on, and essentially what that number currently is a number that's 607% of their tax base, or the municipal net debt limit, whichever of the two is less. And so the argument is at that level they would have reached their maximum capacity, that they really wouldn't have much additional ability to sell bonds locally.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erickson, does the department typically review these requests and make comments on them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskin, yes, there's a process that has to be followed, and Mr. Strom was referring to it in his excellent report. Mr. Strom, I can't thank you enough for the detail you went to explain this, but yes.
No.
Maybe Mr. Strom would like to elaborate.
No.
Your follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I apologize for walking in late, so I'm not going to make Mr. Strom rehash what he's already said. I'll simply look at the tape. But so Representative Erickson, the department has reviewed this, and do they recommend this for funding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, what my bill is about is reducing the tax rate to give some relief to the taxpayers of these districts. The department has recommended this through the governor's proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any further questions? Anything further, Representative Erickson?
Yes, Chair Newman. I would like the members and you to hear from Foley Superintendent Fred Nolan, who's really been the researcher, the mainstay of this effort. You will see all the districts that are listed, and we have met with many of them, but he has really been the spark behind this change in legislation. And because he's made this trip here, I'd like us to hear from him about the need for this.
Mr. Nolan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Brett Nolan, Superintendent of Schools, Foley Public Schools, Minnesota. And I'm simply delighted to be here and see the attention this bill has taken, has been given, and Researcher Strom has been very, very helpful in this process and has done a very good job. We came down last year. And it was included in the omnibus bill, you note by the number 027, it was ready to be put in, and is also included in the governor's proposal, both for capital loans that are existing and for new capital loans. He has an important piece that adjusts the rate also, because that rate was overestimated by the effects of the 2001 tax effort. These are loans which may or may not be forgiven. What really happened in the Foley area is like having an adjustable rate mortgage with the state as your banker. And all of a sudden, the repayment rate was increased, so the term was reduced. As the term moves back out into the future, then this will be much closer to the original agreement that the Foley School Board in 1989 thought that it agreed with the state. And so with that, I appreciate your time and would urge you to pass this tax fairness bill, because it gets to the rate that was in existence prior to 2001 tax compression for these 20 school districts. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Nolan? Is there anything further, Representative Erickson?
Representative Newman, I would just like to renew my motion that House File 27 be included, or at least be considered for inclusion in the 2005 Education Omnibus Bill.
Okay, with no further questions, we'll be laying House File 27 over for possible inclusion into the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, we're going to next take up the Science Museum of Minnesota or Educational Programs presentation. Would the presenters come down? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself and then please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Eric Jolly. I'm the president of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Joining me today is Dave Chittenden, vice president of education for the Science Museum of Minnesota. I'm delighted to have the invitation to come here and look forward to sharing some of the exciting things that are happening at the Science Museum with regard to supporting education across this state. Many people know the Science Museum of Minnesota for its work. It's a great place to visit for field experiences for students, but we're certainly far more than that, although that is not an unimportant part of who we are. Today, this week alone, over 4,000 students will be visiting the Science Museum of Minnesota just down the street. But at the same time, more than 4,047 students will be reached through programs in their own schools conducted by the Science Museum of Minnesota. We are one of the state's leading partnerships in service to education for this state, and I appreciate the time to share with you a few of the highlights of where we're going and what we do. You may not know us for some of our other work as well. The Science Museum of Minnesota maintains a 600-acre research facility at Marine on St. Croix. We're one of the world's leading research agencies for mercury methylation. We're also one of the top three researchers for lake bed core sampling in the world, and on behalf of the U.S. government, have traveled to every continent to do research this year alone. We use our researchers to tell stories, to inspire students, and to inform the public. We're also a collections museum, which has over 1.75 million objects in our collections, which we consider to be one of the most valuable resources to the state of Minnesota. Resources that are used to track environmental changes, provide student experiences in our programs on the floor, and also translate knowledge to the classroom. We're also a production division. We produce our own exhibits, and if you travel to another museum somewhere in the nation and say, gee, that looks familiar, you can probably rest assured that it was designed, built, and sold or rented by the Science Museum of Minnesota, as we also are the leading producer of IMAX large format films of any science museum in the world. We do all of this to subsidize our programs in education. And we do that through these sales and rentals and research programs, through bringing in over $5 million in grants from federal and private sources to help us provide programming for Minnesota students. We think today, more than ever, science education is an essential literacy for our future. The five top job growth categories for the next 10 years are going to be in science-related fields. That sector of our economy is growing at three times the rate of the rest of our economy. Jobs requiring college experience will increase by 19% over the next decade. Most of those jobs will be in science and technology programs. Yet this is where Minnesota is at greatest risk. In the next decade, high school graduates from Minnesota are projected to decline by nearly 11%. For the last decade, students moving into high-tech, computer science, mathematics disciplines has been on the decline. The future of our workforce and the future of our state depends on inspiring students to move forward in science education. We believe we do that well. We serve the state with more than 140,000 students coming to us on field trips. We serve the state by going to 103,000 students in their own classrooms through school outreach programs across the state. We serve the state by being the number one provider of teacher professional development in the state. We are the provider of choice, doing more teacher professional development than the university. We provide teacher training programs particularly aimed at middle and elementary school teachers because the research shows that that's a place where we can make a difference in giving content and pedagogical mastery to these teachers. We've been trying to renegotiate our role as a partner with the state and with state's educational institutions. And in the short time that I've been here, I've been overwhelmed by the amount of camaraderie and support that we have received from other state organizations and from educational service groups. We know that the research indicates there are three essential elements to students succeeding in science education. The first one is evident to everyone: capacity. We need to give students a high level of capacity so that they have the skills to move on to ever more rigorous and complex materials. And so we've invested in the state in high-quality resources and materials, teacher training, and through the Science Museum of Minnesota, teacher professional development. We know that if a child hasn't mastered Algebra 1, they're not going to succeed in calculus. But we know something more important, that you can have the finest program in the world with the best teacher standing in front of those students, but if the student is staring out the window, if they don't believe the field is of interest to them, if it's not something that's important, if they're not engaged, they're not going to advance. And so we look at programs to enhance student capacity, and we pair them with students to enhance, or with programs to enhance student engagement. If students aren't engaged, if they can't imagine they will succeed, they're not going to move on. In this nation, we've closed the achievement gap between 12th grade girls and boys in mathematics to within one percentage point on every national major scale, except the SAT, which has psychometric issues I would be very glad to discuss. Yet women go into quantitative disciplines only one-fourth as often as men. And our research indicates it's because we have not properly engaged. They feel, perhaps accurately so, that that's a hostile environment. The future of this state cannot allow those perceptions to continue. We have to teach young women as well as young men that they can achieve in the sciences, in mathematics, in quantitative disciplines, and we're developing programs around engagement that are aimed to do just that. But if you get a student engaged, if you teach them and they gain highest level of capacity, but their school doesn't offer AP calculus, they won't have an option of becoming an engineer realistically. And so we're also concerned with the continuity programs, those system supports and programmatic opportunities that assure every student can succeed to their dreams. If a student doesn't have a knowledgeable and caring adult, a school counselor who can give them guidance in the programs they need to go, no matter how high quality our capacity programming is, no matter how engaged they are, they're not going on. Students who lack scholarship opportunities, who don't have proper preparation, who were tuned into McDonald's math instead of Microsoft math, aren't the students who will succeed in this future. And so in this year, the Science Museum of Minnesota has undertaken partnerships with the leading science education presenters in this state to assure that at the granular level of the individual student, every student gets engagement, capacity, and continuity. Because without any one of those, a student will not advance. We can't do it all, but we can see that it gets done. The Science Museum of Minnesota is a great place to spark interest and excite students. And as you've heard, we're a great place to train teachers. Now, today, we're looking for coherence to bring those programs together so that we not only excite students, but are doing it in the areas where their capacity needs will be developed by their school systems. We support their teachers in having the ability to present that material in effective and engaging ways, and we work with statewide organizations to assure continuity. We are one of the best investments in business, public-private partnerships that this state has. With businesses, we work with Flint Hills in rural and core city communities to provide more than 4,000 students incredibly intensive programming on-site in their schools and then here, where they have a chance to not only visit the Capitol, but engage in programming in our classroom and even sleep with the dinosaurs. You can still have fun while mastering science. We work with educational partners. We are the residence for SciMath Minnesota. Science Museum of Minnesota is that provides that residence. We are in partnership with the U. We work with the Elementary and Middle School Principals Associations. We work in every county in this state with educational leadership. And we're partners with the government, bringing in funding from such diverse sources as USAID and the National Science Foundation to subsidize an incredible array of programs that not only makes us the provider of choice for teacher professional development, but the affordable provider of choice for teacher professional development. I came here because I believe the Science Museum of Minnesota provides the state an incredible array of jobs, economic resources, programmatic resources, educational programming in every county, and a real source for pride in having one of the finest collections of materials representing science, history, and currency in this state. We do research and we organize knowledge for the purpose of creating an informed electorate in inspiring the next generation of scientists. And I thank you so much for your interest in the programs that we're bringing to this state. I would be delighted to tell you about more of what the Science Museum is doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representatives.
Thank you, Dr. Jolly. Any questions for Dr. Jolly? Representative Bissons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Is there any federal funds at all that go to support the Science Museum? And if so, at what level?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. We do receive a significant amount of federal funds. This year, $3.8 million in federal funds will be coming to the Science Museum of Minnesota. Those are predominantly from the National Science Foundation. We do receive from a few other federal sources. All of these are grant-related funds, and they are funds that we use to try and leverage resources that we can share further with the state.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just looking at the brochure and on page 9 in particular, there's a comment that the state is the museum's only public source of general operating support. So this is, am I then to assume or believe that none of the federal dollars can be used for general operating support, or do you choose not to use any of the federal dollars for general operating support?
Dr. Jolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. We would love to use that money for general operating support. That is prohibited. Almost all of this money is grant money, which creates an unusual economic model, one that only parts of our government could imagine. And that is, we contract to perform and provide a certain amount of work for a set amount of money. If we provide that amount of work for less money, we return it. Therefore, no incentive to save, sadly. And if we have to provide additional funds to finish that work, we take the loss. So the two outcomes that are possible from federal funding is you lose money or you break even. You're not allowed to acquire materials, by and large, and you may not use it for general operating support, very sadly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Newman. Sir, do you have follow-up on both your field trips and outreach so you know that the teachers and students are implementing or following through with what they have seen and learned at the Science Museum or through your programs?
Dr. Jolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. I am a strong proponent of research-based outcome programming and have been for all of my professional career. We track our students for their progress and outcome. We've watched school performance reports improve after schools have been involved. We provide pre-training for teachers as well as follow-up training to the programs. I will ask Dave Chittenden, our Director for Education, to also speak to that.
Mr. Chittenden.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as Dr. Jolly said, we do some follow-up with school visits and the work that we do with schools. For any of the grant-funded programs, we do extensive evaluation and follow-up, and this is one area that we believe very strongly needs to be done to see how we can refine and improve our programs and service to the schools. We are clearly in partnership with the schools to try and improve science, technology, engineering, math, education, and good evaluation research is a part of that effort.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Newman. A follow-up question. Can you give a specific example of feedback that you've had in one of the areas?
A very good example is a school in Osseo district. And this was a school, elementary school, that in 4 months transformed itself from a normal elementary standard curriculum to a math science magnet. Our staff, our teacher professional development staff and school outreach staff went into that school, worked with the entire faculty of that school and the student body as well to transform that school. It has been, from the principal's perspective, an unmitigated success. If I could, if you would indulge me a moment, I do have, I think I brought it, a statement from the principal. And if you would allow me, I'd like to read that into the record. Staff from the Science Museum of Minnesota provided an exciting week of staff development for Edgewood teachers, which started us on the journey to being a successful math and technology magnet school. Their message inspired our new model. What's the big idea? Standing for inquiry, discover, explore, and achieve. Our students have already felt the difference in our school, stating, we ask more questions now because we have lots more to wonder about. And we used to be told how to do things. Now we are given what we need, and we figure it out. Our students are excited about learning both in school and beyond the walls of the classroom. At a recent meeting with the science specialist, curriculum specialist in the Osseo District, he cited this school as a premier example of the combination of enrichment that we can bring to a school paired with the
dedicated staff that you find in many elementary schools, leading to greater success in science and math.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heidrichman.
Thank you, Chair Newman. Question again, and it has to do with finance, and I've always had a difficult time of the state getting into financing various agencies and institutions where they don't belong. But in fairness, I know what some of the good things that you've done. I know I've got some students coming up from Minnewaska staying there, I think, on Thursday night. And I want to compliment you with your program, the outreach program, the field trip program. I mean, you've been doing a lot of good, positive things. So this is something where I have a little easier defending, at least back home. But my question is, back in 1993, it seems like there was a funding, you received funding from the state as well as from Ramsey. Why did the city of Ramsey all of a sudden walk away from helping fund the Science Museum when it's there?
Dr. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative, having not been here for more than 11 months, I'm going to at the moment defer to my director, Dave Chittenden, and then I will add, if I may, my own perspective on this, but we'll start with the facts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and I wish our CFO was here. He could explain it much better. Essentially, what happened was mandated services in Ramsey County began to overwhelm the Ramsey County budget, and what was considered discretionary spending began to peel away, and unfortunately, we were considered discretionary spending on the part of the county. They were concerned about mandated services, prisons, fire protection, police, etc. And that's one of the challenges that we have been having to deal with, that we are essentially viewed as a discretionary service. But I would also suggest that when you look at the services that we're providing schools and teachers across the state of Minnesota, I don't believe that that population, that audience, would consider us discretionary. I would think they would consider us mandatory.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I might also follow up.
Dr. Jolly.
Thank you. These cuts, as you may imagine, came at a very difficult time for the Science Museum, and I would put them in context because I think that the figure should be amplified in its impact. When I observed the loss of 40% of the state funding paired with the loss of 100% of the Ramsey County funding, we also noticed that we were following shortly on the tail of 9/11, a disastrous time for this nation and for our schools when they canceled most of their field trips. When you cancel a field trip and you have that small pot of money aside, you spend that money somewhere else. It doesn't get replaced. We've found that it has been very difficult for schools to have the resources, and they have relied on us serving the county and serving with support from the county and the state, and we have struggled hard not to cut back on some of those fundings. We still, regardless of losing our county support, do not charge a differential fee for any county in the state for any service we provide, no matter how distant it is. And I appreciate your noticing the struggles that can bring to us.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jolly, I guess as we look at the operating support and the requests, one thing that occurs to me is whether or not your board, the Science Museum is a private organization, but I'm just wondering whether or not your board might not look at making recommendation to the legislature that this actually becomes a public organization if a large amount of your funds are going to come from public sources, then would it not be better for you to just simply become a public resource rather than a private organization?
Mr. Jolly.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, thank you for your question. While we report that $750,000 of our budget does come from the state, that is actually, and that amounts to a significant amount of our unrestricted general operating funds, It is actually a very small portion of our total budget of over $28 million. We, in fact, amplified the state's investment 30-fold. I believe that our board has considered our stance many times over the years as being a private rather than public partnership, and our ability to leverage on behalf of the state for federal, private contributions and other dollars is really quite significant. And in fact, our private contributions to general operating funds are $2.3 million, which is a burden the taxpayer does not need to bear, and a benefit which they get to reap.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jolly, thank you for that bit of information. I wouldn't have found it in the brochure, and so I appreciate filling in that blank. I guess I have one other question, and this on a totally different thought pattern, but the Science Museum having a core, a core mission of bringing science education to children in the state of Minnesota. Have you guys discussed at all looking at being involved in the creation of charter schools with a specific focus on science and science learning? Has that been a part of your discussions? Are you even exploring such an idea?
Mr. Jolly?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I want to also note, yes, you would not have found that in this particular material that we've handed out, and in part, one would understand this is material represented to our funding source in the state, which is natural resources and environment. We currently have no requests before this committee. We have looked at charter schools and continue to be interested in them. We have a strong relationship with a museum magnet school at this time and a key program staff on site at the school. Our hope to have a charter school is something that we would move on cautiously, in that we want to maintain our ability to be the largest provider of science education across the state and not lose our resources to that. Dave, would you like to add anything?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, we had looked several years ago very seriously at starting a charter school and talked with the St. Paul District being as a possible sponsor for that. And we remain in some discussion with the St. Paul School District. Some of you may know we have an 11-year magnet school partnership that Dr. Jolly alluded to called the Museum Magnet, which 2 years ago was a federal blue ribbon school, and won a wonderful honor for the hard work that its staff had done. We continue to look at how we can serve schools and the K-12 community, and a charter school perhaps will be in our future. It's certainly an interesting and innovative development within the K-12.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it was a wise decision on your part not going the charter school route, because I think had you done that, you would have been limited as to what you can do elsewhere. Because I know for a fact that there's a lot of homeschoolers that do use your facility as well as private schools, and you do a very good job of getting in and out of state with your presentations as well. And I think had you done that, I think it would have limited your access to the rest of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the presenters for the information. It's been a while since the Science Museum has crossed my path in this place for any kind of presentation. I recall, it brings to memory that some years ago, I think it was at least on a biennial, if not annual basis, we did have a legislative, I think it was an evening at the Science Museum where we were able to get a little bit more hands-on look, and it's been a few years since I've been in the Science Museum and look at the materials, and I'm just thinking that that might be something for us to note for future reference. I realize our schedule is loaded up now, but I would like to see in more detail some of the materials that kids are working with and some of the sequence of materials and just all of that. So maybe it's something, Madam Chair or Mr. Chair, that we could put on our list for an interim kind of activity, because I do know that I've lost contact with, you know, some detail and feeling for the programs that we're having presented here in this short time.
Well, I know, gentlemen, that you guys are not funded through education,
mm-hmm.
but you are funded and you provide a lot of educational programs, and I just thought it would be interesting for us to hear a little bit about it. So I really appreciate very much your being here, and thank you, and keep up the good work. I get my grandchildren over there usually once a year, so...
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. It's a pleasure to be here. You will be seeing a lot more of the Science Museum of Minnesota as we reach more deeply into the state, and I appreciate the opportunity to share more information about this phenomenal resource that the state has for itself.
Thank you. And now the Children's Museum. And this is funded through the education budget. Welcome. Is it Ms. Caruso?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Sarah Caruso, and I am the president of the Minnesota Children's Museum. Sitting next to me is a board member and a familiar face to all of you I know, Representative Nora Slawick. I'd also like to take a minute to introduce some other supporters from the of the museum who are here. Maureen Quam, who is a parent and volunteer in the Minnetonka School District, serves on a variety of councils and committees and is also the program coordinator for Destination Imagination. Maureen and her husband have been board members of the Children's Museum collectively for almost 9 years. I have two of my senior staff members here, Catherine Day, who is our Vice President of External Relations, and Kelly Finity, who is our Senior Director of Education. I would also like to mention, in the strong spirit of bipartisanship which we hold at the Minnesota Children's Museum, Senator Jeff Michel is also on our board.
Thank you.
Nora, I think, wanted to make some opening comments, Madam Chair.
Oh, all right. Representative Slawick.
Madam Chair, Nora Slawick, State Representative 55B. Thank you for the opportunity just for very briefly to lend my support to the Children's Museum and to say they've done a wonderful job of providing children's programming through the museum. I wanted to take a quick poll and see how many of you have been there in the last 2 years. Anybody been there? Okay. A couple people, the ones with kids or grandkids. And that leaves the rest of you. I want to challenge you to come and see the museum. There's been a lot of changes, a lot of updating. As Representative Dorn said, he wants to see the Science Museum. Well, I hope you'll come see the Children's Museum, and I'd be happy to arrange that for you. So basically, I wanted to lend my support. Also to say this has been funded through the governor's budget, and I do hope it will also be funded through the House budget, and also that you will come visit the museum soon. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a brief presentation to familiarize you with the museum. Let me start by saying it's a pleasure to follow our peers at the Science Museum. We often joke that children graduate from the Minnesota Children's Museum and move on to the Science Museum. Our core audience is children 0 to 10, and the Science Museum picks them up in that late grade school period and moves forward. Dr. Eric Jolly and I are very collegial colleagues, and I think you'll see the complementary role that the two institutions play for each other. Our vision is to create experiences that spark children's learning. And I know that you all understand here how important early childhood learning is. Learning begins when a child is born. A two-year-old is learning at an extremely rapid rate, and their brain is developing at a rate that really exceeds brain development in later childhood. So creating experiences for children to learn at a young age is an extremely important goal for the well-being of the children and the future taxpayers of this state, and that is what we're all about. I have three hopefully simple messages to share with you. First is that the museum is a statewide resource with statewide reach. We are a place where learning happens with deep educational content, and we extend that educational content through significant long-term partnerships with educational groups. The museum is located on the corner of 7th Street and Wabasha in downtown St. Paul. We've been in that building for about 9 years. In our most recent year, we had over 400,000 visitors, and it was our third year of attendance growth, which to us is something we're very proud of. It really speaks to the relevance of the work we do by the ever-increasing audience that we have at the museum. Nearly 20% of our visitors come from outside the 7 metro area. Almost all the counties are represented by our visitors that come from around the state, and 10% of our visitors are tourists who come from outside Minnesota. And behind a very important access initiative, nearly 20% of our visitors come to the museum at free or reduced prices. It is our goal to have the museum accessible to all children, not just those children and families who can afford to pay our standard membership or general admission price. Here's the map of our great state, and in blue are the counties from which we have had visitors in the past year. We also have statewide reach at amongst our schools. 77,000 school children, teachers, and their chaperones visit our museum each year. And we are particularly pleased that 44% of those students come from greater Minnesota, again, outside the 7-county area. And then a slight majority, 54%, come within the 7-county area. But when one considers the age of our visitors, kindergarten, first, second graders, coming from great distances clearly indicates the value of what we are offering these school groups in terms of the visits. And the yellow on the map represents the school districts that have come to the museum for field trips. You can, as the purple brochure indicates, there's a variety of ways to visit the museum as a school. You can have a free self-structured visit. You can have a classroom visit. We can provide learning materials both before and after the visit to support curriculum. We have a menu of options for the schools to choose from when they choose to participate at the Children's Museum. I want now to talk about the deep educational content that supports every child's visit, whether they come with a school group, a babysitter, a YMCA group, or with their parents, which is the most, or grandparents, which is really the most common way to come and visit. We have 5 permanent galleries and 2 changing galleries, and at all times in each of those 7 galleries, the exhibits are designed to support academic learning standards. And Kelly Finity, who is a professional educator, did point out to me, I didn't phrase my example exactly correctly, and those of you who are teachers will, I hope, forgive me. But what I wanted to point out is in one of our very popular galleries, the World Work Gallery, in support of the physical science standard, we have a lot of componentry that teaches children about motion. For example, in the crane and in the warehouse and in the waterworks, children are moving small boats along waterways. They are using a crane to lift blocks and move them from one level to another. And all of these skills are allowing children to have hands-on experience with simple machinery, which supports the learning standard of motion. And I could give you countless examples of how we have developed our exhibits to support these learning standards. We are not simply creating fun exhibits that we have kind of dreamed up in our basement. Everything that we do is in support of the higher goal of learning in the classroom. I also wanted to speak briefly to our education programming, which is complementary and supportive of the work that the exhibits bring forth. An example of that is we have a class called Patterns Everywhere, where kindergarten and first grade children can come and have a one-hour class where they are learning concepts related to patterns and fractions, mathematical reasoning, and spatial sense and geometry. And so they are out in the galleries looking for patterns and shapes and looking at holes and halves and quarters in an environment which is very appealing to them, such as our Community Faces and Places Gallery or a traveling exhibit that we recently built and are now touring nationally, Clifford the Big Red Dog. I think children tend to skip in the door and skip out the door of the children's museum, not knowing how much they're learning, which is just fine with us, because when you're having fun, the learning just happens seamlessly, especially with this young audience. We work very hard to support Ready for Kindergarten initiatives. Of the visitors who are not with classes, our just our self-directed visitors who come with parents tend to be very young, and they compose a strong foundation for us. 94% of the self-directed visitors are children 5 and under. And so many of the pre-literacy and the early math and science concepts that we are seeding, we believe, are playing an integral role in getting children ready for kindergarten, which clearly is a high priority among all of us who are working in early education right now. And all of our 7 galleries have activities designed for the very young child. It's not as though we have 1 gallery for the young child and 6 or 7 galleries that are for the older child. Every gallery, there's something that a 2, 3, and 4-year-old can do and learn and feel successful doing in that gallery. I also wanted to highlight that we have significant long-term deep partnerships with important educational groups throughout the state. St. Paul Public Schools is our neighborhood school district. Pat Harvey is on our board. And with her cooperation, we have developed a very deep partnership with the early elementary grades called Weaving Resources. Every kindergarten, first, and second grader in the St. Paul Public Schools comes to the museum once each year. So they have 3 visits in total to the museum that have complete wraparound with curriculum, including learning trunks and teacher-assisted curriculum activities as well. So that is a very deep partnership, which we are proud of, and we would very much like to expand to other school districts as the opportunity and resources allow. We also have worked with the Minneapolis schools on a much smaller scale with the health curriculum in the second grade that we call Hands on Health. We have a wonderful partnership with the University of Minnesota and the Baby Space Project, which is developing physical spaces in inner city daycare programs, which are really enhancing the intellectual stimulation and physical activities of babies and 1- and 2-year-olds. And we also have partnerships with the St. Paul and Dakota County Library Systems, as well as the Head Start programs in Ramsey, Anoka, and in Minneapolis. Pat Harvey, I just wanted to mention a quote that she has said about us. She talked about our partnership as a perfect example of what we can accomplish when we work together. We're very committed to partnerships that have reciprocal benefit to both ends, and we work very hard to make that happen. And I think that's also evidenced by the teacher comments and surveys that we get back after teacher visit. Our satisfaction rate from teachers is in the 95% range. It was when I came to the museum a year ago, I said, can these be real? They're so high. And indeed, they are that high. And this quote from the Willow River School is one that is not atypical. And of course, we're proud. The best field trip we've taken, very well organized, and great experience for our rural children. I'd also like to let you know that the museum has been recognized on a national level. In 2002, we received the highest award possible from our industry association, the Association of Children's Museums, related to our partnership with the St. Paul Public Schools. We also have received federal funding. We are much smaller than the Science Museum, and so major federal grants are not something that happen with the same level of frequency. But we have received funding from the National Science Foundation, from IMLS, which is the Federal Agency for Libraries and Science at Museum Studies, and we also have received funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. So we, too, are bringing federal dollars to the state. I'd just like to give you a sense of the museum's financial picture. Our operating budget is about $4.6 million. And again, just by basis of comparison, I believe the Science Museum is in excess of $25 million a year. We have received in the past $260,000 per year of state funding, which represents about 6% of our operating budget. We do have a balance of earned income of 60% to contributed income of 40%, which we feel is a healthy balance. balance and one which we are committed to maintaining. We also have a significant payroll of over $2 million with 70 full-time equivalent employees. We are requesting this hearing, and as Representative Slawick mentioned, we have been recommended through the Department of Education in the governor's budget that we our funding level be maintained and renewed as it has been for the past several bienniums at $520,000 over the two-year period. It does represent a important source of funding for us, and we believe it is allowing us to achieve, in partnership with the state, many good things for the youngest citizens of this state. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Are there questions for Ms. Caruso? I see none. You must have covered absolutely every base. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
For being here. We will move ahead now to the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research. Thank you so much, all of you. Mr. Reed.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Lynn Reed. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. With me today is my colleague Mark Caveman, who is the Project Director for our Educational and Research Arm, the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research. We don't typically appear before the Education Committee, so members may appreciate a little background about our association. Our standard logo or saying is an independent voice for good government and sound tax policy since 1926. That's we're actually about to hold our 79th annual meeting of members on February 24th, next week. And we developed a 501c3 organization in the early 1980s. It was called the Minnesota Tax Foundation, but it remained fairly dormant for a number of years. And in recent years, we've reactivated it, renamed it the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research, and brought Mark on to do the project direction through the center. We have outside board members on that center, including John Brandel of the Humphrey Institute, Dan Loritz is Vice President of Hamline University, and Art Rolnick, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank, plus other MTA directors are on our board for the center. This study that we produced was our first formal foray into education finance, and it was an education for us. Mark really spearheaded it a couple years ago in finding the kind of leading edge research that's represented in this study. And I'm going to turn over the presentation to Mark to handle the overview. And we're excited about this study. We view this as an introductory study. We didn't know for sure what we would find. We had no preconceived ideas about what we would find. And we would like to take this initial work and follow up in subsequent years with a more in-depth examination. But it looks like we're having a little trouble with
difficulty.
But we'll still start with the slides, and maybe the technician can work. So, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Mark Caveman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Caveman with the Minnesota Taxpayers Association and the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research.
Welcome, Mr. Caveman.
I think all of you have copies of the slides. You may need them today because we're having some difficulties here. I would, before starting, like to draw your attention to a couple of other handouts that we gave you. The first is a comparison of education finance reform studies. We've had a lot of questions with regards to how our study compares or differs from the Governor's Finance Task Force efforts, and there's sort of a two-page side-by-side summary, which hopefully will give you some perspective on how they're similar and how they're different. The other handout, too, is a frequently asked questions sheet. Based on having given presentations like this a lot, we find that a lot of the similar questions keep popping up. We attempted to capture those questions and hopefully help you folks understand and interpret the study better. All right. On slide two, I'll catch up here as soon as things load up. What we tried to do is answer questions which are sort of a part of the permanent debate around education finance. Specifically, what does an adequate education cost, using the language of the courts, or sufficient for basic education, using available measures to define adequacy that we have here in the state? Is the state spending enough to provide an adequate education as defined? Are state education aids being distributed fairly in light of those, in light of the cost issues? What kind of educational outcomes are we actually getting, the amount of money being spent, which gets to the efficiency of education spending? And finally, if we were to embark on a process of attempting to link education performance to education finance, how do we do that and do that well and do that fairly? And the presentation I have will roughly follow those issues. One of the most important ideas that sort of permeate the whole study is this on this slide, to sort of set the table, that district cost is not the same thing as district spending. District spending captures a lot of different things. Certainly, districts choose to spend different levels of money to achieve higher levels of educational outcomes or different types of educational opportunities for their students. Districts may spend more efficiently than others. And there's also sort of the environmental factors that affect how much it actually costs to deliver an education. Really what this study is about is attempting to segregate those things. What we want to do is isolate the impact of environmental factors from those things that are within the district's control. So the cost of an adequate education, the cost of adequacy as we describe here, sort of removes those things like educational outcomes or the things that are within the district's control and focuses on those things that the district has no real control over. That is the cost of adequacy estimates that we generate. Just a couple of words about the study methodology. We use an approach called data envelopment analysis, which is really a very sophisticated form of benchmarking. What we basically try to do is identify those districts that achieve their test scores at the lowest levels of spending in the state and then benchmark all the other districts against them. And importantly, as the second bullet points out, that environmental factors are included in this analysis. They don't unfairly compare districts with each other. This is a apologize for the clutter here, but this is a sort of a snapshot of the methodology. As you can imagine, there's some heavy-duty mathematics going on behind the scenes here in each of these steps, involving linear programming and regression analysis. But suffice to say, I think this highlights both the advantages and disadvantages in some respect. The disadvantage, of course, being that the mathematics involved are very complex and it's difficult to explain. However, one of the primary advantages we feel being that it adds a level of empirical rigor to this very complicated area that more subjective types of studies that involve opinions and judgments of professionals and things of that nature may not be able to provide.
Mr. Haveman?
Yeah.
What outcome measures and test scores did you use?
That is on three slides. Three slides ahead.
That's coming?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a word about environmental factors, which is really the crux of this study. Ideally, what you'd like to do in something like this is to develop the cost factors in a specific context like the state of Minnesota. that required time and money that we didn't have. Fortunately, there's an extensive body of literature on cost function studies in public education that we tap. And these are the factors that have been shown to matter, as it were, in other education finance studies around the nation. We use those and incorporate them into our analysis. The one notable one that's missing from here is identified on the bottom there is limited English proficiency. In doing the analysis, we found that the incorporation of these other factors basically controlled for limited English proficiency, and so it didn't need to be a separate cost factor that was analyzed. Just a quick discussion of the advantages and disadvantages of DEA. We think one of the real strengths of this is that it's a benchmarking based on actual district results. We are finding those districts that are able to achieve actual test scores and outcomes at lowest levels of spending in the state and comparing districts with those. So we're not dealing with hypothetical school districts with state average teachers and things of that nature. These are real districts with real results and real spending numbers. And the ability to introduce relative efficiency considerations into cost estimates, we think, is another strength. Oftentimes, that element is missing, and DEA is primarily an efficiency-focused methodology. So we think that brings some strength into the analysis as well. Two key disadvantages of this methodology. The basic rule of this analysis is that you're efficient, or your lowest cost or lowest spending producer of your educational outcomes unless it can be proved otherwise. And one of the rules of benchmarking is that you can't compare yourself with a district that has better sort of socioeconomic conditions than yours. This creates a problem for districts that have very harsh socioeconomic characteristics that have no peers to benchmark against. And so the methodology says you're basically efficient by default. You can't prove that not the lowest cost or lowest spending producer in the state. So you get that efficiency score. And that has implications for interpreting the results, especially with some of the districts like Minneapolis and maybe some of the other districts that have high levels of Native American populations in the state, which I'll get to a little bit later on. The other primary disadvantage is that the evaluation is based on how education is delivered and administered in the state or in that district at that time, in this case being 2002. We really can't project cost reductions that are available for practices that are not being used in the state. So, and again, this has implications for interpreting the results, as we'll see later on. Madam Chair, getting to your question, now beginning to look at the study itself. We consulted with the Department of Education and asked them for the best measures that we currently have available to define a basic or adequate education. And these were the standards that we used. The Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Test for 3rd and 5th grade math and 3rd and 5th grade reading. And 1420 represents the basic skills level for those tests. Similarly, the 8th grade math and reading and the 10th grade writing tests and the scores indicating adequacy or basic skills levels are provided there. And finally, we use the graduation rate or non-dropout rate for data-related purposes and the adequacy measure there. So those were our working definitions of an adequate education. Again, you can have differences of opinion whether that is good enough. And fortunately, this methodology can accommodate desires to ratchet up the standards and the performance levels in these areas as well. These are basically the standards and measurements that we had. If more were available, we would incorporate them. I think more will become available over time, and they can be also factored into this type of analysis. So how do we do on these adequacy standards? I think this chart here shows how Minnesota's reputation for public school excellence is in the state. A remarkable 80% of all the districts measured, 317 out of 342, I believe, for which we had data, achieved all 8 standards. And again, I think, emphasize again, this probably should be considered minimum adequacy standards. This is the basic skills level, and the low end of the basic skills level is defined by the Department of Education. So we do very well. Our technical consultant, Dr. John Ruggiero, who is the principal investigator from the technical standpoint, the DA methodology, saw those results and was blown away. He's tremendously impressed with the quality of public education here in Minnesota. Putting all this information into that DEA model and running the regressions and the linear programming equations, you get the summary cost of adequacy estimates. And you see a significant diversity across the state. The state averages for the 1420 standards is about $6,200. The median a little bit less than that. But the district high of over $14,400 and the district low of about $5,500. And again, that the difference between the high and the low really captures the influence of socioeconomic and related conditions, those environmental cost factors highlighted earlier on one of the slides, and their influence on delivering a basic education.
Mr. Haveman, I think your really high districts are probably, we have a couple of Indian reservations that are very remote, Net Lake, et cetera. I think that's where these really high numbers come in. So we don't have many at that rank at all. I mean, that's kind of a number of $1,000 above, you know, almost any other district.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The number of the district high there is actually Minneapolis. There are like two or three districts, in St. Paul being one, I think, that are around 10,000 or higher. One district featuring the Native American populations, I believe it was Red Lake, actually had to be tossed from the methodology because we couldn't even be able to mathematically extrapolate what the cost of adequacy was for that school district. They met zero standards, and the methodology just couldn't even extrapolate what that number might be. So certainly an issue there.
We have a couple of questions at this point. Representative Heidger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to your point, Madam Chair, I agree with you 100%. It's just not only the Red Lake, but I think if you take the 1% of the high cost of the really rural districts, you take the 1% out of it, and you take the 90%, you look at where funding is at, you'll find some major discrepancies. If you've got to first take that 1% out, and I think from there you look at 99% of the kids where they're funded, there's some major discrepancies. And you first need to do that, though, I think.
Do you have a response, Mr. Hedman? Otherwise, we have another question.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there is a significant clustering of the cost estimates around what I guess could be considered sort of state average students in the state. Certainly the 14-4 and numbers in that area do represent outliers, although, again, that is the Minneapolis School District, and that does represent a significant population of students.
Madam Chair?
Sorry. I was looking for which Mr. Reed, I'm sorry.
As I glance down the table in the back of our study, Minneapolis is the only one shown over 10,000. So the St. Paul is 9,900, I believe. And as he said, that some had to be thrown out, but they do cluster around the median, and there aren't very many because the average and median are pretty close. So there isn't quite as much spread as that summary would.
So the numbers that you have for Minneapolis is 14,446 per student?
Madam Chair, that's for the cost. This methodology determined that's what it would cost for them to meet all eight standards of the basic measures.
Madam Chair, if I may add again, getting back to a point I made earlier, to interpret that correctly, that assumes the existing administration and delivery of public education in Minneapolis in 2002. If we didn't change anything in how Minneapolis delivered and administered public education, we would expect to have to pay $14,446 to deliver basic adequate education or basic education results, achieving these levels of adequacy for Minneapolis public school students. Now there are two, if I may, there are two ways to sort of interpret that, and we've had a lot of calls on this. One is that obviously we're not spending enough. Two is that the way public education is administered and delivered for this population in the Minneapolis School District needs to be changed to reduce that cost of adequacy. And I think points can be made on both sides. That the study suggests, or we conclude, that there are, that issues like poverty may be underfunded in the state. But similarly, there are opportunities to reduce the cost of an adequate education by changing the administration delivery of public education in some of these problematic districts.
Representative Plenzing.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a larger question that I'd like to save till the end, but I have a more technical question about this slide in particular. What does the one asterisk mean by the 1420 and the two asterisks mean by the 1500? I see later on there's a definition of asterisks relating to significance, but I wasn't sure what it meant on this slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative,
Mr. Hibman.
The 1420 standards are that basic education level. We want to do a little bit of sensitivity analysis to see, well, what would happen if we as a state are not satisfied with the basic level of education? 1500 represents proficiency on the MCA tests. So we ran the analysis again to see if we wanted to achieve proficiency at the MCA with the MCA scores, and but retain the basic skill scores for the junior high and the high school and the graduation rate, how would the numbers change? And you can see there that the numbers go up accordingly, not surprisingly, because additional investment needs to be made to bring students up to a higher level of performance.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Mr. Haveman?
Haveman,
I'm sorry. I think you essentially answered my question, but this is a projection of what it, based on your criteria, what it should cost based on the administration we have and based on these parameters, what it should cost to have these individual schools get this level of education. I haven't looked ahead yet to see, did you total up the total of all the cost of adequacy to see how it came out compared to what we're doing, or are we getting to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we're getting to that.
Okay, thank you.
We've done some analysis.
I'll be patient. Yeah.
Mr. Haveman.
Getting to that question, Madam Chair, here's some analysis that we did in terms of answering a couple of the questions that are common to the public education finance debate. Our district spending enough to provide an adequate education? Here we look at district per pupil spending as a percentage of this per pupil cost of adequacy. And you can see that on a state average basis, on a mean basis, districts are spending about 20% more per pupil than the cost of adequacy. Notably, the district high and the district low, there's some significant differences. The highest district was spending about 80% more than its cost of adequacy on a per pupil basis, while the district low is about 25% less than what was necessary to achieve adequacy on a per pupil basis. And again, from a sensitivity standpoint, looking at applying the 1500 standards, you can see the numbers change there. Notably, only eight districts.
Representative Bradding has a question. Sorry to interrupt you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haveman, I'm wondering if maybe you'll get to it later, and if you will, just I can wait. But if not, is there any profile of the districts that are over, have more money compared to what they need versus those who are at the 43%?
Madam Chair, Representative, we did not get into an examination of the features of the districts that spend in certain ways. We didn't have the time or the money to sort of dive in and try to understand what's going on.
Seeing no other questions, please continue, Mr. Haveman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Notably, only eight districts had per pupil spending less than the per pupil cost of adequacy. Shifting a little bit to the state, is the state meeting its responsibility to provide enough financial support to deliver an adequate education within school districts? What we had to do, because of the time frame, the year 2002, we added back the 2002 general education levy to simulate education finance as it exists right now with the takeover of the general education levy. And you see that on a, if you just took the state aggregate, meaning the sort of total cost of adequacies from the state, and compared it to the total basic education aid in the state, it's funded at about 80%. The district average is higher. It's about 90%, reflecting issues pertaining to the distribution of aids in the state. And again, they're a district high. One district received about 40% more in general education aids than above and beyond their per pupil cost of adequacy, and another district about less than about 57% or 56% less. This is a conservative estimate, as you'll note there on the bottom. This does not include state referendum aid or any categorical aids. This includes just basic education aid and its related component.
So, Mr. Haveman, as the dollars that we're looking at here include nothing in the way of referendum dollars?
It's
strictly state aid. There's no levy dollars in there anywhere?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Well, we added back the general education levy to simulate education finance that exists right now. The referendum aid has been excluded. This is basic education aid and the compensatory aids that are part of state basic education aid. But it also excludes categorical aids. Turning attention to the equity or fairness in state aid distribution, with these cost of adequacy estimates, we were able to develop a cost of adequacy index, which is basically what each district should receive relative to the state average to achieve adequacy standards. And then we compared that to sort of an implied cost index based on the actual delivery of 2002 state aids. This is what districts actually received from the state relative to the state average. So by comparing what we calculate from the cost of adequacy index to what the state actually provided, we can get a sense of the level of overcompensation or undercompensation certain districts got. The next table shows the comparison results there. 142 districts were overcompensated, 134 districts were undercompensated, and the number of districts correctly compensated, based on our analysis, was 40. You see some example districts there below. Albert Lea, for example, we project based on our analysis that they should receive 2% more than the state average to achieve adequacy standards based, again, on their sort of socioeconomic cost factors that apply to their district. In actuality, they received 1% less than the state average, so this district is slightly underfunded. Moving down there, there are two notable outliers that point to some issues. Brooklyn Center should, and based on our analysis, receive about 32% more than the state average to accommodate cost factors beyond their control in the school district if the state only compensates them for 2% more than the state average. On the other hand, South Kuching, certainly the sparsity issues up there and the size of the district, which is a cost factor, influences their adequacy cost, and they should receive about 2% more than the state average. However, we found that, you know, when you look at the state aids, they received 47% more than the state average, suggesting to us that issues perhaps like sparsity aid might be overfunded in delivering, for purposes of delivering adequate education. And then you have situations like White Bear Lake, where our analysis and the actual delivery of 2002 state aids were matched perfectly. Interestingly, the correlation between the two indexes, our index and the implied index from actual state aids, was 0.66, which is pretty high. We conclude that basically the state does a pretty good job of compensating districts for the right cost factors. However, some adjustments in the delivery some adjustments in the design of the compensation systems for these cost factors may need some improvement.
Madam Chair. Representative Griley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haveman, are you suggesting that sparsity aid pays for more than sparsity?
Mr. Haveman.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that argument can be made. The challenge with all of these compensatory aid for cost factors is that you really want to have a good understanding of how the cost factor influences the ability to deliver an education. And it is my understanding, and perhaps Tim or Greg could correct me on this, but a lot of the formulas that are designed to compensate districts for these cost factors aren't based necessarily on empirical examination of how these cost factors truly influence cost. And as a result, more work could be done to sort of fine-tune those.
Representative Bernardi. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had that same question, and I'm just concerned about it. We don't have Representative Eakin here, but to say that they're receiving, being some of the rural districts, and I'm guessing that this has happened to a number of school districts that receive sparsity, that'll show that they're getting too much. Well, Representative Eakin, you're here. Good. We're asking questions for you. But would that be accurate? I mean, you didn't dive into the data to find that out, that if the school districts are receiving sparsity, it's looking like they're getting too much funding, and that's what your report is finding, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Haveman.
Madam Chair, Representative, when we looked at the recipients of sparsity aid, we did find sort of consistent pattern of those districts having larger general fund reserves. I don't have the...
And Madam Chair, if I might add too, is it's understandable in light of the way
Mr.
some
Reed.
Of the... Pardon me?
Mr. Reed, I was just
sorry.
Identifying you, sorry.
Yes. It's understandable in the way some of the formulas were developed. There's a quite a bit of common sense aspect to them, but also not always empirical evidence available. So, and this is a pretty new method. And we're just looking after the results. You look down and say, well, what are the common characteristics here? So some things jumped out like sparsity. It's not a fully tested hypothesis, but it does show up as associated.
Representative Pipe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Wait,
to that,
a minute.
Okay.
She has a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up question to what the testifier was commenting on regarding reserves. Did you look into that? Because I just happen to know one school district that's rural, and there's a very small school district sitting on a $1 million reserve. And in my district, we have statutory operating debt just got out of it and hovering around zero. So did you analyze that, and did you find some trends of who's sitting on larger reserves as proportionate to their population?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we did a...
Haveman.
We did a bit of an examination of that, and I'm quoting from our report. According to the Department of Education, reserve balances of around 10% of annual expenditures are generally recommended. Statewide, district unreserved general fund balances as a percent of annual expenditures was 8.8% in fiscal year 2002. For districts receiving sparsity aid, the average balance reserve balance is 22.5%. For districts receiving $500 or more per pupil in sparsity aid, reserve balances were 31.9%. And the largest recipient of sparsity aid had a reserve balance of 64.8%. So there is some evidence that suggests that sparsity aid is being overcompensated.
Wow.
Okay.
Representative
Madam Chair, yes, to that point, and I think if you take you're looking at less than a lot of the schools that receive a high proportion of that is less than 1% of the kids. If you take those sites comprise 1% of the kids, I think even your numbers will show that. But also the numbers that do not show is in a lot of those districts, you'll see a lesser amount of kids that sign up for the free and reduced lunch program even though they are qualified for it. You'll take, for example, I always use Todd County as an example, as being, some say, the poorest county in the state of Minnesota on average salary, or the second poorest. But when you look at that county, their sign up for the free and reduced lunch program is right probably around where you die on EVF. I'm just saying the numbers do not always correlate exactly what they should be receiving. And again, I think if you take the smallest, and I don't know how small Cochin gene is or whatever, you take that 1% out of it, and you kick those 1% of those students out of it, and you work with the 99%, you're going to come up with completely different numbers. Am I right or wrong?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Haveman.
I'm talking about not sites. I'm talking about total percentage of kids and how we fund them.
Mr. Reed, were you going to answer that?
Sure, Madam Chair. Representative, I believe that those tails, those extremes, wouldn't dramatically affect the median or the average numbers that we come up with. But in every statistical study like this, you're going to find outliers, or you're going to find things that don't really fit the pattern. And you look at the common sense kind of results, and that's why this is an initial result. And frankly, in the 8 or 10 districts that do get a lot of sparsity aid, if you added up all the money that this empirical study shows is probably given in excess, it's a very small amount of money. It's not very much at all. It just shows up on a per pupil basis as something that's really dramatic. I don't think it would affect the median or average scores that much, but it does show up on the extremes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Heidgerger.
Yes, a follow-up on that, and I will disagree to a large degree on what you just said, and the fact that if I take the 1% of the student body and all the sites that go with it, and I take the other 99, that 1%, the numbers are there, will show with, I think this is figuring out food and transportation, everything in it, is probably around $8,400. You take that 1% out, now from 0 to 300 enrollment, and you go from 300, and you use the bottom number from 300 to 600, and look at what those students are getting, you're going to be dropping down about 7,300. Then you go to the other end of the students where you'll have, for example, Minneapolis School District. You're going to see a major discrepancy from that point to that point. So it depends upon how you fudge your numbers, but if you take the 1% with the sites, include it with that 1%, and take them out of there, you're going to come up with completely different numbers.
I think we should move on because we are going to run out of time here. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Mr. Heffelman. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. We've been looking at some of the schools where, by a certain definition, they may be receiving overcompensation. With your analysis pointing to sparsity as a possible locus for that amount of money, if we go to the other end of the spectrum and we see schools like Minneapolis here, that appears to be underfunded to the tune of about 80%, do you have a similar explanation or guess where the inadequacies might lie, where the underfunding might lie?
Madam Chair, Representative, when we embarked on this study, we made a strategic decision to take the idea of simplifying education finance to heart. It is possible with this analysis that we did here to do an investigation that allows you to identify which types of cost factors are underfunded or overfunded. We chose instead to try and collapse all these cost factors into one adjustment to simplify the education finance system. So as a result of that decision and how we designed this report, we really can't inform whether it's the poverty issue that's being underfunded or the limited English proficiency dynamic that's being underfunded. Or it is possible to do that with this methodology, but we chose an approach that allowed you to sort of collapse all these cost factors into one single adjustment with the idea of that would help simplify the education finance system. So unfortunately, we don't have the type of information that you're looking for.
Mr. Haveman, what you did is you looked at scores, test scores, and then you looked at how districts were funded. Did you look at how well, what kind of a job districts do with the education? Was there any consideration here other than test scores and funding? You know what I'm saying? I mean,
Madam Chair, one of the challenges of these types of studies is that the premise is always that you have some measurements by which you can do this type of quantitative analysis. And unfortunately, we only have 7 to work with. certainly it would be nice to have a broader portfolio of standards and measurements for equality or an adequate public education. That information just doesn't exist. As our frequently asked question sheet points out, however, we feel it's pretty unlikely that the cost estimates would change that much if you did include other types of measurement standards, because basically what this methodology is doing is identifying the cost to deliver these basic skills levels of performance in these areas and some other unmeasured levels of performance and everything else that public education is about. We don't know what level of performance we're achieving with these numbers in everything from science and social studies and history and choir and band and all that. The academic studies suggest that achieving basic skills levels in the basics, math, reading, and writing, are likely to translate into basic skills levels of performance in some of these other areas.
Right.
But that's the best information that we have.
It just looks to me like nobody is looking at how, what kind of a job a district does of actually providing education, the professionalism of the teachers, or any of those things. We're just looking kind of at scores versus dollars. And I think there are a lot of other important factors, and granted, you probably didn't know a good way to use those. But we have two more questions, and then we're finished here. Representative Greiling, as quickly as possible.
Madam Chair, that's my question. Are we going to get a chance to have these gentlemen back, or is this it? Because I find this a fascinating discussion. I thank them for their study, and I feel like we're just beginning to discuss what they're recommending, and I would hope we would have a little more time.
I suppose I can answer that one.
Yeah.
I will just see how it goes. You know, we'll just have to see how it goes because we have a number of bills and a lot of stuff to do. So we may get back to this.
To that point.
Representative Klensing.
Are we
going to
finish the other three slides about the efficiency factors, or is this going to be it?
No.
Okay.
I guess if you want to run through those very quickly, we can take 5 minutes. We do have another committee coming in here, though. That is no excuse.
Yeah, I don't come late.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd...
At least finish up because you've got, I think, just one page or so left.
Okay. Much can be said about the factors affecting district efficiency, but we tried to identify what characteristics of districts were related to district efficiency scores, both positively and negatively. And just to highlight a couple of them for your attention, index of state revenue is the percent of revenue that the district receives from the state. We found all else being equal, and these are all very high levels of statistical significance, the more money a district received from the state, the more likely it was that lower levels of efficiency, all else being equal. And one of the key implications for this, of course, is that with the reform package of 2001, all districts are now more reliant on the state. So it suggests to us that we need to be mindful of the fact that there are opportunities for reduced efficiency as a result of that state takeover that we need to be mindful of. For time's sake, I'd like to jump down to the pupil-to-teacher ratio one. It's important to realize that a lot of these relationships may not be linear, and this is the case with the pupil-to-teacher ratio. We found that efficiency improves with lower pupil-to-teacher ratios up to a point, and then the additional cost of higher ratios begins to overwhelm any incremental improvements in educational test scores. So you have this type of relationship going on. We found that inflection point, and this is not class size because this includes all district teachers, is 18 to 1. The reason why it was statistically related to inefficiency is because I believe the state average is 15 to 1. With regards to teacher experience and percent of teachers with master's degrees, in retrospect, I really wish we had done the same nonlinearity test because it is very likely that the same issues would apply here. We'd find situations where experience and advanced degrees improve test score outcomes up to a point, then the compensation required starts to take over the incremental effect and it goes down. Unfortunately, we didn't test for linearity or nonlinearity there. We know, again, from the efficiency scores that wherever we are on that state average of of teacher experience and master's degrees were on that downslope side, according to this study. But it would be interesting to figure out what that is. Finally, just some concluding issues regarding state aid. Our study, I think, points out the fact that it is possible to create basic for pupil education and aid that is linked to the achievement of adequacy standards, that is also responsive to variations in district costs of achieving adequacy standards. This education funding system can be designed not to reward inefficiency. As I said earlier, it is possible to create a single cost factor adjustment to accommodate district all these different cost factors. That is a change of pace from what we have right now with individual aid adjustments for individual cost factors. Again, we did it from the standpoint of simplification. It is possible to do the same type of analysis and preserve the idea of linking specific types of compensatory aids to certain types of cost factors, and to focus the debate on what factors affect costs. If what we did was attempt to model how you'd go about doing this, if we were to head down this path, several things would need to be done. First of all, we obviously want to have clear consensus on behalf of the state on all the adequacy standards that define an adequate education and the ability to measure them. But we only have 7. I'm certain that others would want to contribute other ideas, and that's the whole point, is to get state consensus in terms of what is an adequate education and how do we measure it and proceed accordingly. Similarly, further testing and clear consensus on cost factors. We took what the academic literature had to give us. It is likely that there might be some unique situations or unique aspects of Minnesota public schools that require other types of cost factors to be included. Let's test them, let's analyze them, and see if they hold merit and should be included in the analysis. Some mechanism to reduce impact of anomalies in performance measurement. We were concerned, of course, that one day's worth of tests could define your financial future as far as the district is concerned. I don't know of a solution to that. Maybe a 5-year moving average of test scores or something of that nature would accommodate that high-stakes testing one day defining your future issue. Some mechanism to address lag times. We've heard that a lot can change. Typically, there's like a 2-year lag between the availability of the socioeconomic information, the spending information, and the current school year. As we did this in 2004. This is based on 2002 information, the latest available. Clearly, things can change from a socioeconomic standpoint within these districts. Some mechanism to sort of be able to catch up to the current conditions might be appropriate. I don't know what that would be right off the top of my head. And again, greater district ability to explore and adopt administrative and delivery practices that reduce the cost of adequacy. This gets to the Minneapolis conundrum in the sense that we know, or we model based on our analysis, that would, under the existing delivery and administration of public education in Minneapolis, we would expect to have to pay about $14,500 to get people up to adequacy. And are there ways to reduce that in those outlier districts, reduce that cost of adequacy at lower cost to taxpayers in the state?
Mr. Haveman and Mr. Reed, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we are totally out of town at the time, and another committee wishes to be in here.
Thank you, Madam.
Motion to approve.
Representative Ethan has looked at the minutes in his attendance time.
Madam Chair, to the minutes, are we going to have Mr. Bryce back again with the Department of Natural Resources and Trust?
Madam Chair, are we planning to meet until maybe July?
I was thinking maybe how about every evening from now till the end of session?
Well, to that point, though, I think that they're looking at taking monies out of education and putting in DNR.
There will be a bill to that effect.
Okay, good. We're going to address that again.
He will hear the bill.
All right. Thank you.
All right. All those in favor of any additions or changes to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are passed. Meeting is adjourned.